Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. Torch Song by John Cheever. After Jack Laurie had known Joan Harris in New York for a few years, he began to think of her as the widow. She always wore black, and he was always given the feeling, by a curious disorder in her apartment, that the undertakers had just left. This impression did not stem from malice on his part, for he was fond of Joan. They came from the same city in Ohio and had reached New York at about the same time in the middle 30s. They were the same age, and during their first summer in the city, they used to meet after work and drink martinis in places like the Brevoort and Charles's, and have dinner and play checkers at the Lafayette. Joan went to a school for models when she settled in the city, but it turned out that she photographed badly, so after spending 6 weeks learning how to walk with a book on her head, she got a job as a hostess in a Longchamps. For the rest of the summer, she stood by the hat rack, bathed in an intense pink light and the string music of heartbreak, swinging her mane of dark hair and her black skirt as she moved forward to greet the customers. She was then a big, handsome girl with a wonderful voice, and her face, her whole presence, always seemed infused with a gentle and healthy pleasure at her surroundings, whatever they were. She was innocently and incorrigibly convivial, and would get out of bed and dress at 3 a.m. if someone called her and asked her to come out for a drink, as Jack often did. In the fall, she got some kind of freshman executive job in a department store. They saw less and less of each other, and then, for quite a while, stopped seeing each other altogether. Jack was living with a girl he'd met at a party, and it never occurred to him to wonder what had become of Joan. Jack's girl had some friends in Pennsylvania, and in the spring and summer of his second year in town, he often went there with her for weekends. All of this, the shared apartment in the village, the illicit relationship, the Friday night train to a country house, was what he had imagined life in New York to be, and he was intensely happy. He was returning to New York with his girl one Sunday night on the Lehigh Line. It was one of those trains that moved slowly across the face of New Jersey, bringing back to the city hundreds of people, like the victims of an immense and strenuous picnic, whose faces are blazing and whose muscles are lame. Jack and his girl, like most of the other passengers, were overburdened with vegetables and flowers. When the train stopped in Pennsylvania Station, they moved with the crowd along the platform toward the escalator. As they were passing the wide, lighted windows of the diner, Jack turned his head and saw Joan. It was the first time he had seen her since Thanksgiving or since Christmas. He couldn't remember. Joan was with a man who had obviously passed out. His head was in his arms on the table, and an overturned highball glass was near one of his elbows. Joan was shaking his shoulders gently and speaking to him. She seemed to be vaguely troubled, vaguely amused. The waiters had cleared off all the other tables and were standing around Joan, waiting for her to resurrect her escort. It troubled Jack to see, in those straits, a girl who reminded him of the trees and the lawns of his hometown, but there was nothing he could do to help. Joan continued to shake the man's shoulders, and the crowd pressed Jack past one after another of the diner's windows, past the malodorous kitchen, and up the escalator. He saw Joan again later that summer when he was having dinner in a village restaurant. He was with a new girl, a southerner. There were many southern girls in the city that year. Jack and his belle had wandered into the restaurant because it was convenient, but the food was terrible and the place was lighted with candles. Halfway through dinner, Jack noticed Joan on the other side of the room, and when he had finished eating, he crossed the room and spoke to her. She was with a tall man who was wearing a monocle. He stood, bowed stiffly from the waist, and said to Jack, "We are very pleased to meet you." Then he excused himself and headed for the toilet. "He's a count. He's a Swedish count," Joan said. "He's on the radio, Friday afternoons at 4:15. Isn't it exciting?" She seemed to be delighted with the count and the terrible restaurant. Sometime the next winter, Jack moved from the village to an apartment in the East 30s. He was crossing Park Avenue one cold morning on his way to the office when he noticed, in the crowd, a woman he had met a few times at Joan's apartment. He spoke to her and asked about his friend. "Haven't you heard?" she said. She pulled a long face. "Perhaps I better tell you. Perhaps you can help." She and Jack had breakfast in a drugstore on Madison Avenue, and she unburdened herself of the story. The Count had a program called The Song of the Fjords, or something like that, and he sang Swedish folk songs. Everyone suspected him of being a fake, but that didn't bother Joan. He had met her at a party and, sensing a soft touch, had moved in with her the following night. About a week later, he complained of pains in his back and said he must have some morphine. Then he needed morphine all the time. If he didn't get morphine, he was abusive and violent. Joan began to deal with those doctors and druggists who peddled dope, and when they wouldn't supply her, she went down to the bottom of the city. Her friends were afraid she would be found some morning stuffed in a drain. She got pregnant. She had an abortion. The Count left her and moved to a flea bag near Times Square, but she was so impressed by then with his helplessness, so afraid that he would die without her, that she followed him there and shared his room and continued to buy his narcotics. He abandoned her again, and Joan waited a week for him to return before she went back to her place and her friends in the village. It shocked Jack to think of the innocent girl from Ohio having lived with a brutal dope addict and traded with criminals, and when he got to his office that morning, he telephoned her and made a date for dinner that night. He met her at Charles's. When she came into the bar, she seemed as wholesome and calm as ever. Her voice was sweet and reminded him of elms, of lawns, of those glass arrangements that used to be hung from porch ceilings to tinkle in the summer wind. She told him about the Count. She spoke of him charitably and with no trace of bitterness, as if her voice, her disposition, were incapable of registering anything beyond simple affection and pleasure. Her walk, when she moved ahead of him toward their table, was light and graceful. She ate a large dinner and talked enthusiastically about her job. They went to a movie and said goodbye in front of her apartment house. That winter, Jack met a girl he decided to marry. Their engagement was announced in January, and they planned to marry in July. In the spring, he received, in his office mail, an invitation to cocktails at Jones. It was for a Saturday when his fiancée was going to Massachusetts to visit her parents, and when the time came and he had nothing better to do, he took a bus to the village. Joan had the same apartment. It was a walk-up. You rang the bell above the mailbox in the vestibule and were answered with a death rattle in the lock. Joan lived on the third floor. Her calling card was in a slot in the mailbox, and above her name was written the name Hugh Bascom. Jack climbed the two flights of carpeted stairs, and when he reached Joan's apartment, she was standing by the open door in a black dress. After she greeted Jack, she took his arm and guided him across the room. "I want you to meet Hugh, Jack," she said. Hugh was a big man with a red face and pale blue eyes. His manner was courtly, and his eyes were inflamed with drink. Jack talked with him for a little while and then went over to speak to someone he knew who was standing by the mantelpiece. He noticed then, for the first time, the indescribable disorder of Joan's apartment. The books were in their shelves and the furniture was reasonably good, but the place was all wrong somehow. It was as if things had been put in place without thought or real interest, and for the first time, too, he had the impression that there had been a death there recently. As Jack moved around the room, he felt that he had met the 10 or 12 guests at other parties. There was a woman executive with a fancy hat, a man who could imitate Roosevelt, a grim couple whose play was in rehearsal, and a newspaper man who kept turning on the radio for news of the Spanish Civil War. Jack drank martinis and talked with the woman in the fancy hat. He looked out of the window at the backyard and the ailanthus trees and heard in the distance thunder exploding off the cliffs of the Hudson. Hugh Bascom got very drunk. He began to spill liquor as if drinking for him were a kind of jolly slaughter, and he enjoyed the bloodshed in the mess. He spilled whiskey from a bottle. He spilled a drink on his shirt and then tipped over someone else's drink. The party was not quiet, but Hugh's hoarse voice began to dominate the others. He attacked a photographer who was sitting in a corner explaining camera techniques to a homely woman. "What did you come to the party for if all you wanted to do was sit there and stare at your shoes?" Hugh shouted. "What did you come for? Why didn't you stay at home?" The photographer didn't know what to say. He was not staring at his shoes. Joan moved lightly to Hugh's side. "Please don't get into a fight now, darling," she said. "Not this afternoon." "Shut up," he said. "Let me alone. Mind your own business." He lost his balance, and in struggling to steady himself, he tipped over a lamp. "Oh, your lovely lamp, Joan," a woman sighed. "Lamps!" Hugh roared. He threw his arms into the air and worked them around his head as if he were bludgeoning himself. "Lamps, glasses, cigarette boxes, dishes. They're killing me. They're killing me, for Christ's sake. Let's all go up to the mountains and hunt and fish and live like men, for Christ's sake." People were scattering as if a rain had begun to fall in the room. It had, as a matter of fact, begun to rain outside. Someone offered Jack a ride uptown, and he jumped at the chance. Joan stood at the door, saying goodbye to her routed friends. Her voice remained soft and her manner, unlike that of those Christian women who in the face of disaster can summon new and formidable sources of composure, seemed genuinely simple. She appeared to be oblivious of the raging drunk at her back, who was pacing up and down, grinding glass into the rug, and haranguing one of the survivors of the party with the story of how he, Hugh, had once gone without food for 3 weeks. In July, Jack was married in an orchard in Duxbury, and he and his wife went to the West Chop for a few weeks. When they returned to town, their apartment was cluttered with presents, including a dozen after-dinner coffee cups from Joan. His wife sent her the required note, but they did nothing else. Late in the summer, Joan telephoned Jack at his office and asked if he wouldn't bring his wife to see her. She named an evening the following week. He felt guilty about not having called her and accepted the invitation. This made his wife angry. She was an ambitious girl who liked a social life that offered rewards, and she went unwillingly to Joan's village apartment with him. Written above Joan's name on the mailbox was the name Franz Denzel. Jack and his wife climbed the stairs and were met by Joan at the open door. They went into her apartment and found themselves among a group of people for whom Jack, at least, was unable to find any bearings. Franz Denzel was a middle-aged German. His face was pinched with bitterness or illness. He greeted Jack and his wife with that elaborate and clever politeness that is intended to make guests feel that they have come too early or too late. He insisted sharply upon Jack sitting in the chair in which he himself had been sitting and then went and sat on a radiator. There were five other Germans sitting around the room drinking coffee. In a corner was another American couple who looked uncomfortable. Joan passed Jack and his wife small cups of coffee with whipped cream. "These cups belonged to Franz's mother," she said. "Aren't they lovely? They were the only things he took from Germany when he escaped from the Nazis." Franz turned to Jack and said, "Perhaps you will give us your opinion on the American educational system. That is what we were discussing when you arrived." Before Jack could speak, one of the German guests opened an attack on the American educational system. The other Germans joined in and went on from there to describe every vulgarity that had impressed them in American life and to contrast German and American culture generally. "Where," they asked one another passionately, "could you find in America anything like the Mitropa dining cars, the Black Forest, the pictures in Munich, the music in Beirut?" Franz and his friends began speaking in German. Neither Jack nor his wife nor Joan could understand German, and the other American couple had not opened their mouths since they were introduced. Joan went happily around the room, filling everyone's cup with coffee, as if the music of a foreign tongue were enough to make an evening for her. Jack drank five cups of coffee. He was desperately uncomfortable. Joan went into the kitchen while the Germans were laughing at their German jokes, and he hoped she would return with some drinks, but when she came back it was with a tray of ice cream and mulberries. "Isn't this pleasant?" Franz asked, speaking in English again. Joan collected the coffee cups, and as she was about to take them back to the kitchen, Franz stopped her. "Isn't one of those cups chipped?" "No, darling," Joan said. "I never let the maid touch them. I wash them myself." "What's that?" he asked, pointing at the rim of one of the cups. "That's the cup that's always been chipped, darling. It was chipped when you unpacked it. You noticed it then." "These things were perfect when they arrived in this country," he said. Joan went into the kitchen, and he followed her. Jack tried to make conversation with the Germans. From the kitchen there was a sound of a blow and a cry. Franz returned and began to eat his mulberries greedily. Joan came back with her dish of ice cream. Her voice was gentle. Her tears, if she had been crying, had dried as quickly as the tears of a child. Jack and his wife finished their ice cream and made their escape. The wasted and unnerving evening enraged Jack's wife, and he supposed that he would never see Joan again. Jack's wife got pregnant early in the fall, and she seized on all the prerogatives of an expectant mother. She took long naps, ate canned peaches in the middle of the night, and talked about the rudimentary kidney. She chose to see only other couples who were expecting children, and the parties that she and Jack gave were temperate. The baby, a boy, was born in May, and Jack was very proud and happy. The first party he and his wife went to after her convalescence was the wedding of a girl whose family Jack had known in Ohio. The wedding was at St. James, and afterward there was a big reception at the River Club. There was an orchestra dressed like Hungarians and a lot of champagne and scotch. Toward the end of the afternoon, Jack was walking down a dim corridor when he heard Joan's voice. "Please don't, darling," she was saying. "You'll break my arm. Please don't, darling." She was being pressed against the wall by a man who seemed to be twisting her arm. As soon as they saw Jack, the struggle stopped. All three of them were intensely embarrassed. Joan's face was wet, and she made an effort to smile through her tears at Jack. He said hello and went on without stopping. When he returned, she and the man had disappeared. When Jack's son was less than 2 years old, his wife flew with the baby to Nevada to get a divorce. Jack gave her the apartment and all its furnishings and took a room in a hotel near Grand Central. His wife got her decree in due course, and the story was in the newspapers. Jack had a telephone call from Joan a few days later. "I'm awfully sorry to hear about your divorce, Jack," she said. "She seemed like such a nice girl. But that wasn't what I called you about. I want your help, and I wondered if you could come down to my place tonight around 6. It's something I don't want to talk about over the phone." He went obediently to the Village that night and climbed the stairs. Her apartment was a mess. The pictures and the curtains were down, and the books were in boxes. "You moving, Joan?" he asked. "That's what I wanted to see you about, Jack. First, I'll give you a drink." She made 2 old fashions. "I'm being evicted, Jack," she said. "I'm being evicted because I'm an immoral woman. The couple who have the apartment downstairs, they're charming people, I've always thought, have told the real estate agent that I'm a drunk and a prostitute and all kinds of things. Isn't that fantastic? This real estate agent has always been so nice to me that I didn't think he'd believe them, but he's canceled my lease, and if I make any trouble, he's threatened to take the matter up with the store, and I don't want to lose my job. This nice real estate agent won't even talk with me anymore. When I go over to the office, the receptionist leers at me as if I were some kind of dreadful woman. Of course, there have been a lot of men here, and we sometimes are noisy, but I can't be expected to go to bed at 10 every night, can I? Well, the agent who manages this building has apparently told all the other agents in the neighborhood that I'm an immoral and drunken woman, and none of them will give me an apartment. I went in to talk with one man. He seemed to be such a nice old gentleman, and he made me an indecent proposal. Isn't it fantastic? I have to be out of here on Thursday, and I'm literally being turned out into the street." Joan seemed as serene and innocent as ever while she described this scourge of agents and neighbors. Jack listened carefully for some sign of indignation or bitterness or even urgency in her recital, but there was none. He was reminded of a torch song, of one of those forlorn and touching ballads that had been sung neither for him nor for her, but for their older brothers and sisters, by Marion Harris. Joan seemed to be singing her wrongs. "They've made my life miserable," she went on quietly. "If I keep the radio on after 10 o'clock, they telephone the agent in the morning and tell him I had some kind of orgy here. One night when Philip—I don't think you met Philip, he's in the Royal Air Force, he's gone back to England— One night when Philip and some other people were here, they called the police. The police came bursting in the door and talked to me as if I were I don't know what, and then looked in the bedroom. If they think there's a man up here after midnight, they call me on the telephone and say all kinds of disgusting things. Of course I can put my furniture into storage and go to a hotel, I guess. I guess a hotel will take a woman with my kind of reputation, but I thought perhaps you might know of an apartment. I thought." It angered Jack to think of this big, splendid girl's being persecuted by her neighbors, and he said he would do what he could. He asked her to have dinner with him, but she said she was busy. Having nothing better to do, Jack decided to walk uptown to his hotel. It was a hot night. The sky was overcast. On his way, he saw a parade in a dark side street off Broadway near Madison Avenue. All the buildings in the neighborhood were dark. It was so dark that he could not see the placards the marchers carried until he came to a street light. Their signs urged the entry of the United States into the war, and each platoon represented a nation that had been subjugated by the Axis powers. They marched up Broadway as he watched, to no music, to no sound but their own steps on the rough cobbles. It was for the most part an army of elderly men and women, Poles, Norwegians, Danes, Jews, Chinese. A few idle people like himself lined the sidewalks, and the marchers passed between them with all the self-consciousness of enemy prisoners. There were children among them dressed in the costumes in which they had, for the newsreels, presented the mayor with a package of tea, a petition, a protest, a constitution, a check, or a pair of tickets. They hobbled through the darkness of the loft neighborhood like a mortified and destroyed people toward Greeley Square. In the morning, Jack put the problem of finding an apartment for Joan up to his secretary. She started phoning real estate agents, and by afternoon she had found a couple of available apartments in the West 20s. Joan called Jack the next day to say that she had taken one of the apartments and to thank him. Jack didn't see Joan again until the following summer. It was a Sunday evening. He had left a cocktail party in a Washington Square apartment and had decided to walk a few blocks up Fifth Avenue before he took a bus. As he was passing the Brevoort, Joan called to him. She was with a man at one of the tables on the sidewalk. She looked cool and fresh, and the man appeared to be respectable. His name, it turned out, was Pete Bristol. He invited Jack to sit down and join in a celebration. Germany had invaded Russia that weekend, and Joan and Pete were drinking champagne to celebrate Russia's changed position in the war. The three of them drank champagne until it got dark. They had dinner and drank champagne with their dinner. They drank more champagne afterward and then went over to the Lafayette and then to two or three other places. Joan had always been tireless in her gentle way. She hated to see the night end, and it was after 3 o'clock when Jack stumbled into his apartment. The following morning he woke up haggard and sick and with no recollection of the last hour or so of the previous evening. His suit was soiled and he had lost his hat. He didn't get to his office until 11. Joan had already called him twice, and she called him again soon after he got in. There was no hoarseness at all in her voice. She said that she had to see him, and he agreed to meet her for lunch in a seafood restaurant in the 50s. He was standing at the bar when she breezed in, looking as though she had taken no part in that calamitous night. The advice she wanted concerned selling her jewelry. Her grandmother had left her some jewelry, and she wanted to raise money on it, but didn't know where to go. She took some rings and bracelets out of her purse and showed them to Jack. He said that he didn't know anything about jewelry, but that he could lend her some money. "Oh, I couldn't borrow money from you, Jack," she said. "You see, I want to get the money for Pete. I want to help him. He wants to open an advertising agency, and he needs quite a lot to begin with." Jack didn't press her to accept his offer of a loan after that, and the project wasn't mentioned again during lunch. He next heard about Joan from a young doctor who was a friend of theirs. "Have you seen Joan recently?" the doctor asked Jack one evening when they were having dinner together. He said no. "I gave her a checkup last week," the doctor said, "and while she's been through enough to kill the average mortal, and you'll never know what she's been through, she still has the constitution of a virtuous and healthy woman. Did you hear about the last one? She sold her jewelry to put him into some kind of business, and as soon as he got the money, he left her for another girl who had a car, a convertible." Jack was drafted into the Army in the spring of 1942. He was kept at Fort Dix for nearly a month, and during this time he came to New York in the evening whenever he could get permission. Those nights had for him the intense keenness of a reprieve, a sensation that was heightened by the fact that on the train in from Trenton, women would often press upon him dog-eared copies of Life and half-eaten boxes of candy, as though the brown clothes he wore were surely cerements. He telephoned Joan from Pennsylvania Station one night. "Come right over, Jack," she said. "Come right over. I want you to meet Ralph." She was living in that place in the West 20s that Jack had found for her. The neighborhood was a slum. Ash cans stood in front of her house, and an old woman was there picking out bits of refuse and garbage and stuffing them into her perambulator. The house in which Joan's apartment was located was shabby, but the apartment itself seemed familiar. The furniture was the same. Joan was the same big, easygoing girl. "I'm so glad you called me," she said. "It's so good to see you. I'll make you a drink. I was having one myself. Ralph ought to be here by now. He promised to take me to dinner." Jack offered to take her to Kavanaugh's, but she said that Ralph might come while she was out. "If he doesn't come by 9, I'm going to make myself a sandwich. I'm not really hungry." Jack talked about the Army. She talked about the store. She had been working in the same place for... how long was it? He didn't know. He had never seen her at her desk, and he couldn't imagine what she did. "I'm terribly sorry Ralph isn't here," she said. "I'm sure you'd like him. He's not a young man. He's a heart specialist who loves to play the viola." She turned on some lights, for the summer sky had got dark. "He has his dreadful wife on Riverside Drive and 4 ungrateful children. He..." The noise of an air raid siren, lugubrious and seeming to spring from pain, as if all the misery and indecision in the city had been given a voice, cut her off. Other sirens in distant neighborhoods sounded until the dark air was full of their noise. "Let me fix you another drink before I have to turn out the lights," Jones said, and took his glass. She brought the drink back to him and snapped off the lights. They went to the windows, and as children watch a thunderstorm, they watched the city darken. All the lights nearby went out but one. Air raid wardens had begun to sound their whistles in the street. From a distant yard came a hoarse shriek of anger. "Put out your lights, you fascists," a woman screamed. "Put out your lights, you Nazi fascist Germans! Turn out your lights! Turn out your lights!" The last light went off. They went away from the window and sat in the lightless room. In the darkness, Joan began to talk about her departed lovers, and from what she said, Jack gathered that they had all had a hard time. Niels, the suspect count, was dead. Hugh Bascom, the drunk, had joined the merchant marine and was missing in the North Atlantic. Franz, the German, had taken poison the night the Nazis bombed Warsaw. "We listened to the news on the radio," Jones said, "and then he went back to his hotel and took poison. The maid found him dead in the bathroom the next morning." When Jack asked her about the one who was going to open an advertising agency, she seemed at first to have forgotten him. "Oh, Pete," she said after a pause. "Well, he was always very sick, you know. He was supposed to go to Saranac, but he kept putting it off and putting it off, and..." She stopped talking when she heard steps on the stairs, hoping, he supposed, that it was Ralph, but whoever it was turned at the landing and continued to the top of the house. "I wish Ralph would come," she said with a sigh. "I want you to meet him." Jack asked her again to go out, but she refused, and when the all-clear sounded, he said goodbye. Jack was shipped from Dix to an infantry training camp in the Carolinas and from there to an infantry division stationed in Georgia. He had been in Georgia 3 months when he married a girl from the Augusta boarding house aristocracy. A year or so later, he crossed the continent in a day coach and thought sententiously that the last he might see of the country he loved was a desert towns like Barstow, that the last he might hear of it was a ringing of the trolleys on the Bay Bridge. He was sent into the Pacific and returned to the United States 20 months later, uninjured and apparently unchanged. As soon as he received his furlough, he went to Augusta. He presented his wife with the souvenirs he had brought from the islands, quarreled violently with her and all her family, and, after making arrangements for her to get an Arkansas divorce, left for New York. Jack was discharged from the Army at a camp in the East a few months later. He took a vacation and then went back to the job he had left in 1942. He seemed to have picked up his life at approximately the moment when it had been interrupted by the war. In time, everything came to look and feel the same. He saw most of his old friends. Only two of the men he knew had been killed in the war. He didn't call Joan, but he met her one winter afternoon on a crosstown bus. Her fresh face, her black clothes, and her soft voice instantly destroyed the sense, if he had ever had such a sense, that anything had changed or intervened since their last meeting 3 or 4 years ago. She asked him up for cocktails, and he went to her apartment the next Saturday afternoon. Her room and her guests reminded him of the parties she had given when she had first come to New York. There was a woman with a fancy hat, an elderly doctor, and a man who stayed close to the radio listening for news from the Balkans. Jack wondered which of the men belonged to Joan and decided on an Englishman who kept coughing into a handkerchief that he pulled out of his sleeve. Jack was right. "Isn't Stephen brilliant?" Joan asked him a little later when they were alone in a corner. "He knows more about the Polynesians than anyone else in the world." Jack had returned not only to his old job, but to his old salary. Since living costs had doubled and since he was paying alimony to two wives, he had to draw on his savings. He took another job, which promised more money, but it didn't last long and he found himself out of work. This didn't bother him at all. He still had money in the bank, and anyhow it was easy to borrow from friends. His indifference was the consequence not of lassitude or despair, but rather of an excess of hope. He had the feeling that he had only recently come to New York from Ohio. The sense that he was very young and that the best years of his life still lay before him was an illusion that he could not seem to escape. There was all the time in the world. He was living in hotels then, moving from one to another every 5 days. In the spring, Jack moved to a furnished room in the Badlands west of Central Park. He was running out of money. Then, when he began to feel that a job was a desperate necessity, he got sick. At first he seemed to have only a bad cold, but he was unable to shake it and he began to run a fever and to cough blood. The fever kept him drowsy most of the time, but he roused himself occasionally and went out to a cafeteria for a meal. He felt sure that none of his friends knew where he was, and he was glad of this. He hadn't counted on Joan. Late one morning, he heard her speaking in the hall with his landlady. A few moments later, she knocked on his door. He was lying on the bed in a pair of pants and a soiled pajama top, and he didn't answer. She knocked again and walked in. "I've been looking everywhere for you, Jack," she said. She spoke softly. "When I found out that you were in a place like this, I thought you must be broke or sick. I stopped at the bank and got some money in case you're broke. I've brought you some scotch. I thought a little drink wouldn't do you any harm. Want a little drink?" Joan's dress was black. Her voice was low and serene. She sat in a chair beside his bed as if she had been coming there every day to nurse him. Her features had coarsened, he thought, but there were still very few lines in her face. She was heavier. She was nearly fat. She was wearing black cotton gloves. She got two glasses and poured scotch into them. He drank his whiskey greedily. "I didn't get to bed until 3 last night," she said. Her voice had once before reminded him of a gentle and despairing song, but now, perhaps because he was sick, her mildness and the mourning she wore, her stealthy grace, made him uneasy. "It was one of those nights," she said. "We went to the theater. Afterwards, someone asked us up to his place. I don't know who he was. It was one of those places. They're so strange. There were some meat-eating plants and a collection of Chinese snuff bottles. Why do people collect Chinese snuff bottles? We all autographed a lampshade, as I remember, but I can't remember much." Jack tried to sit up in bed, as if there were some need to defend himself, and then fell back again against the pillows. "How did you find me, Joan?" he asked. "It was simple," he said. "I called that hotel, the one you were staying in. They gave me this address. My secretary got the telephone number. Have another little drink. You know you've never come to a place of mine before." "Never," he said. "Why did you come now?" "Why did I come, darling?" she asked. "What a question. I've known you for 30 years. You're the oldest friend I have in New York. Remember that night in the village when it snowed and we stayed up until morning and drank whiskey sours for breakfast? That doesn't seem like 12 years ago. And that night—" "I don't like to have you see me in a place like this," he said earnestly. He touched his face and felt his beard. "And all the people who used to imitate Roosevelt," she said, as if she had not heard him, as if she were deaf. "And that place on Staten Island where we all used to go for dinner when Henry had a car. Poor Henry. He bought a place in Connecticut and went out there by himself one weekend. He fell asleep with a lighted cigarette, and the house, the barn, everything burned. Ethel took the children out to California." She poured more scotch into his glass and handed it to him. She lighted a cigarette and put it between his lips. The intimacy of this gesture, which made it seem not only as if he were deathly ill, but as if he were her lover, troubled him. "As soon as I'm better," he said, "I'll take a room at a good hotel. I'll call you then. It was nice of you to come." "Oh, don't be ashamed of this room, Jack," she said. "Rooms never bother me. It doesn't seem to matter to me where I am. Stanley had a filthy room in Chelsea. At least other people told me it was filthy. I never noticed it. Rats used to eat the food I brought him. He used to have to hang the food from the ceiling, from the light chain." "I'll call you as soon as I'm better," Jack said. "I think I can sleep now if I'm left alone. I seem to need a lot of sleep." "You really are sick, darling," she said. "You must have a fever." She sat on the edge of his bed and put a hand on his forehead. "How is that Englishman, Joan?" he asked. "Do you still see him?" "What Englishman?" "You know, I met him at your house. He kept a handkerchief up his sleeve. He coughed all the time. You know the one I mean." "You must be thinking of someone else," she said. "I haven't had an Englishman at my place since the war. Of course, I can't remember everyone." She turned, and taking one of his hands, linked her fingers in his. "He's dead, isn't he?" Jack said. "That Englishman's dead." He pushed her off the bed and got up himself. "Get out," he said. "You're sick, darling," she said. "I can't leave you alone here." "Get out," he said again, and when she didn't move, he shouted, "What kind of an obscenity are you that you can smell sickness and death the way you do?" "You poor darling. Does it make you feel young to watch the dying?" he shouted. "Is that the lewdness that keeps you young? Is that why you dress like a crow? Oh, I know there's nothing I can say that will hurt you. I know there's nothing filthy or corrupt or depraved or brutish or base that the others haven't tried. But this time you're wrong. I'm not ready. My life isn't ending. My life's beginning. There are wonderful years ahead of me. There are wonderful, wonderful, wonderful years ahead of me. And when they're over, when it's time, then I'll call you. Then, as an old friend, I'll call you and give you whatever dirty pleasure you take in watching the dying. But until then, you and your ugly and misshapen forms will leave me alone. She finished her drink and looked at her watch. I guess I better show up at the office, she said. I'll see you later. I'll come back tonight. You'll feel better then, you poor darling. She closed the door after her, and he heard her light steps on the stairs. Jack emptied the whiskey bottle into the sink. He began to dress. He stuffed his dirty clothes into a bag. He was trembling and crying with sickness and fear. He could see the blue sky from his window, and in his fear it seemed miraculous that the sky should be blue, that the white clouds should remind him of snow, that from the sidewalk he could hear the shrill voices of children shrieking, "I'm the king of the mountain! I'm the king of the mountain! I'm the king of the mountain!" He emptied the ashtray containing his nail parings and cigarette butts into the toilet and swept the floor with a shirt so that there would be no trace of his life, of his body, when that lewd and searching shape of death came there to find him this evening. And that story was Torch Song by John Cheever from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. Bolus by Maxim Gorky. An acquaintance of mine once told me the following story. While still a student in Moscow, I happened to be living alongside one of those, well, she was a Polish woman, Teresa by name, a tall, powerfully built brunette with heavy, bushy eyebrows and a large, coarse, vulgar face, as if carved out with an axe. The animal gleam in her eyes, a deep bass voice, the gait and manners of a cabman, and her immense strength like that of a market woman, inspired me with an inexpressible horror. I lived in the garret of the house, and her room was opposite mine. I never opened my door when I knew that she was in. But this, of course, happened very rarely. Sometimes I chanced to meet her on the landing, staircase, or in the yard, and she would look at me with a smile which seemed to me cynical and rapacious. Occasionally I saw her in her cups, with bleary eyes, her hair and clothes in disorder, and with a particularly loathsome smile. On such occasions she would meet my eye with an impudent stare and say, "How are you, Pan Student?" And her stupid laugh would increase my dislike for her still more. I would have liked nothing better than to change my quarters in order to get rid of her proximity, but my room was so nice, and the view from my window was so fine, the street below so quiet and peaceful, that I concluded to endure it. One morning, after I had dressed and was sprawling on the cot, trying to invent some sort of an excuse for not attending my classes, the door of my room suddenly opened, and the disgusting bass voice of the Polish woman sounded from the threshold. "Good morning, Pan Student!" "What is it you wish?" I asked her. I saw she looked confused and had in her face a kind of pleading expression, something unusual with her. "You see, Pan Student, I came to beg you to do me a great favor. Don't refuse me, please." Lying there on my cot, I thought that it was just some pretext or other to make my further acquaintance. "Take care, my boy." "You see, I have to send a letter to my native country," she continued in a supplicating, low, tremulous voice. "Well," I thought, "the devil take you. If you wish, I will write it for you." And springing to my feet, I sat down to the table, took some paper, and said, "Well, come nearer, sit down and dictate." She came over, sat down cautiously on the edge of the chair, and looked at me in a rather guilty way. "To whom shall I write?" "To Boleslav Kopshot, in the town of Svensiani, on the Warsaw Railroad." "Well, what shall I write? Speak." "My dearest Bolus, my heart's delight, my beloved, may the Mother of God protect you. My golden heart, why have you not written for so long a time to your sorrowing dove, Teresa?" I could hardly keep from laughing. A sorrowing dove indeed, almost 6 feet tall, with the fists of a prize fighter, and a face so black that it seemed as if the dove had been sweeping chimneys all her life and had never thoroughly washed herself. But I somehow kept my face straight and asked, "Who is this Bolest?" "Bolus, Pan Student," she replied, seemingly offended because of my mispronouncing the name. "He is my affianced." "Affianced? And why are you so astonished? Cannot I, a girl, have an affianced?" "She, a girl? Well, this beats everything I ever heard. Oh, well, who can tell about such matters? Everything is possible in this world. And how long have you been engaged?
The sixth year.
Uh-oh, I thought, and then said aloud, Well, go ahead with your letter. And I must confess, so tender and loving was this message that I would have willingly exchanged places with this Bolus had the fair correspondent been anyone else but Teresa. I thank you from my inmost soul for your favor, Pan student, Teresa said, bowing low. Can I in any way be of service to you?
No, thank you.
But maybe the Pan's shirts or trousers need mending? This made me quite angry. I felt that this mastodon in petticoats was making the blood mount to my cheeks, and I told her quite sharply that her services were not required, and she departed. 2 weeks or so passed. One evening I was sitting at my window, softly whistling and thinking how hard it was to get away from myself. I felt very bored. The weather was as nasty as it could be. To go out that evening was out of the question, and having nothing better to do, I began from sheer ennui a course of self-analysis. This proved dull enough work, but there was nothing else to do. Suddenly the door opened, thank God. Someone was coming to see me.
Are you very busy just now, Pan student?
Teresa.
I thought I would have preferred anyone at all to her. Then I said aloud,
No, what is it you want now?
I wish to ask the Pan student to write me another letter.
Very well. Is it again to Bolus you wish me to write?
No, this time I want you to write a letter from Bolus to me.
What?
I beg your pardon, Pan student. How stupid of me. It is not for me, this letter, but for a friend of mine, a man acquaintance. He has a fiancée. Her name is like mine, Teresa. He does not know how to write, so I want the Pan student to write for him a letter to that Teresa. I looked at her. She seemed very confused and frightened, and her fingers trembled. And though I failed at first to understand what was the matter with her, I at last understood. Look here, my lady, I said to her. You have been telling me a pack of lies. There are no Boluses nor Teresas among your acquaintances. It is only a pretext for coming in here. I tell you outright that there is no use of coming sneaking around me, as I do not wish to have anything to do with you. Do you understand? She grew very red in the face, and I saw that she was strangely frightened and confused, and moved her lips so oddly, wishing to say something without being able to say it. And somehow I began to think that I had misjudged her a little. There was something behind all this, but what?
Pan student, she suddenly began, but broke off, and turning toward the door, walked out of the room. I remained with a very unpleasant feeling in my heart. I heard her shut her own door with a bang. Evidently the poor girl was very angry. I thought the matter over and decided to go in to her and induce her to return. I would write her the letter she wished. I entered her room. She was sitting at the table with her head pressed in her hands. Teresa, I said, will you listen to me a moment? Whenever I come to this turn of the story, I always feel very awkward and embarrassed. But let us return to my narrative. Seeing that she did not reply, I repeated, Listen to me, my girl. She sprang to her feet, came close up to me with eyes flashing, and placing her two hands on my shoulders, she began to whisper, or rather to hum in her deep bass voice. Look you here, Pan student. What of it? What of it if there's no Bolus? And what of it if there's no Teresa? What difference does it make to you? Is it so hard for you to draw a few lines on the paper? Oh, you! And I thought you such a good fellow, such a nice fair-haired little boy. Yes, it is true, there's no Bolus and there's no Teresa. There's only me. Well, what of it?
Allow me, I said, greatly disconcerted by this reception. What is it you are saying? Is there no Bolus?
Yes, there is none, but what of it?
And no Teresa either?
No, no Teresa either. That is, yes, I am her. I could not understand a word. I stared straight into her eyes, trying to determine which of us two had lost our reason. And she returned once more to the table, rummaged for some time in the drawer, and coming back to me, said in an offended tone, Here is a letter you wrote for me. Take it back. You do not wish to write me a second one anyway. Others will probably be kinder than you, and would do so. I recognized the letter she held out to me as the one I wrote for her to Bolus.
Humph!
Look here, Teresa, I said to her, will you please explain to me what it all means? Why do you ask people to write letters for you when you do not find it necessary even to post them?
Post them? Where to?
Why, to this Bolus, of course.
But he does not exist.
I really could not understand a word.
There was nothing left for me to do but to spit and walk out of the room. But she explained herself. "Well, what of it?" she began in an offended voice. "He does not exist. He does not, so..." And she extended her hands as if she could not herself clearly understand why he did not exist in reality. "But I want him to. Am I not as much of a human being as the others? Of course, I know, but it is no harm to anyone that I am writing to him." "Allow me, to whom?" "To Bolus, of course. But he does not exist." "Oh, Mother of God, what if he does not exist? He does not, still to me he does. And Teresa, this is myself, and he replies to my letters and I write to him again." I understood. I felt so sick at heart, so ashamed of myself to know that alongside of me, only 3 paces removed, lived a human being who had no one in the whole world to love and sympathize with her, and that this being had to invent a friend for herself. "Here you have written a letter from me to Bolus, and I gave it to another to read, and when I hear it read, it really begins to seem to me as if there is a Bolus. And then I ask that a letter be written from Bolus to Teresa, that is to me. And when such a letter is written and is read to me, then I am almost entirely convinced that there is a Bolus, and that makes my life easier." "Yes, the devil take it all," continued my acquaintance. "To make a long story short, I began from that time on to write with the greatest punctuality 2x a week letters to Bolus and vice versa. I wrote splendid replies to her. She used to listen to my reading of those epistles and to weep in her bass voice. In return for this, she used to mend my clothes and darn my socks. 3 months later, she was thrown into prison for some reason or other, and by now she must surely be dead." My acquaintance blew the ashes from his cigarette, looked thoughtfully at the sky, and concluded, "Yes, the more a human being has drunk of the cup of bitterness, the more ardently he longs for sweetness. And we, enveloped in our worn-out virtues and gazing at each other through the haze of self-sufficiency, and convinced of our righteousness, fail to understand it. And the whole affair turns out very stupid and very cruel. Fallen people, we say, but who and what are those fallen ones? First of all, they are human beings of the very same bone and blood, of the very same flesh and nerves as ourselves. We have been told the very same things for whole ages, day in and day out. And we listen, and the devil alone knows how stupid it all is. In reality, we too are but fallen people, and more deeply fallen too, probably, into the abyss of self-sufficiency, convinced of our own sinlessness and superiority, the superiority of our own nerves and brains over the nerves and brains of those who are only less crafty than we are, and who cannot, as we can, feign a goodness that they do not possess. But enough of this. It is all so old and stale, so old and stale indeed, that one is ashamed to speak of it." And that story was Bolus by Maxim Gorky from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. The next story is from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Sheppard and James Thomas. The Quail by Rolf Engve. The quail came just before the lilacs bloomed in the green time of their first spring married. The morning was a first warm morning with no frost, only dew. Feeling sun on the bed, she rose earlier than usual. When she saw the quail in the backyard, she woke him. He saw 8 birds scratching earth and pecking in the landlord's garden. He told her they were California quail. The hens were like dowager women, plump and impeccably arrayed in brown and gray. They were escorted by 3 portly males with gray-vested chests and an ascot of black plumage at their throats. Each bird had 1 black plume feather bobbing on the forehead. They wandered the garden like a tour group, stopping to peck in the earth, gliding, aimless and individual, but covied together. The couple dressed, whispering about the birds, and watching them peck breakfast from the lawn. He made coffee, warmed rolls, and they ate at the kitchen table where they could watch the covey. He opened the window. They could smell the morning dampness and apple blossoms. Sun came through the window. The rolls were sweet with raisins, and they did not have to say anything to each other. That evening, on his way home from work, he stopped at a feed store and bought cracked corn. He explained to her that the quail would stay as long as they were fed and well-treated. He scattered the corn near the kitchen window, and at sunset the birds returned. They came very close to the window, pecked at the corn, and took rolling dirt baths in the landlord's garden. She asked him if the birds would eat the landlord's seeds and plantings. He told her that the garden was in no danger as long as they fed the birds cracked corn. After the birds came, they began to set the alarm clock early. At first it was to give them more time for coffee, rolls, and watching the covey. When the lilacs bloomed and the tulips came out, they set the alarm earlier still and made love before rising. She would bathe after, and he would make breakfast, put out more corn for the birds. It was best watching the covey just after sunrise, before the traffic noises, before the landlord let his poodle out. The landlord lived next door with a chicken wire fence dividing the 2 yards. When he let the poodle out, it would be crazy to get at the quail, charging the fence, yapping the insane little dog's bark. The covey would rise, flailing air, then settle in the apple tree's low branches, waiting for the dog to calm himself and drop back to the corn. Before long, he could put corn on the window sill, and the quail would join them for breakfast. If they were quiet and ate without sudden movement, the birds would flutter in the window sill a foot from the coffee pot and roll basket. The birds pecked at the corn, eating one piece at a time. Their beaks tapped the sill, and their eyes gleamed. He removed the screen to see if they would come inside. The 4 cocks were bold, sometimes walking onto the table, preening, ruffling feathers, shaking their plumes. For weeks she tried to feed them sweet roll crumbs from her fingers. The males looked at it, but it was a hen who finally ran to the offered scrap, eyed it sideways with her plume like a hat feather cocked over one eye, and took the crumb. There was a touch of the hen's beak on her fingers. She laughed aloud. The covey exploded from the window sill. When a week passed and the birds finally began coming to the window sill again, the hen always took one crumb. Evenings they would sit in lawn chairs and watch the covey feed. When the early roses bloomed and the landlord's garden sprouted, they saw a hen mated. It was in the garden, and they did not see the courtship, only the act when the cock, all gray and brown, feathered with black throat feathers, twisted the hen's neck down with his bill. The hen writhed in the soil as the cock mounted her and beat her sides with his wings. And the landlord's wife railed from inside the landlord's house. "Tom! They're in the garden again! Tom!" The landlord ran from the house, waving his arms, hissing, his neck wrinkled and old, his hair white stubble. The birds rose, flailing air. His wife held the screen door open, leaned out, screeching, "Tom, you got to do something about them birds. We got to eat that damn garden this winter. Now you want to eat this winter. You do something." The screen door made a whacking slam, and she was out, stooped, her poodle at her feet, her legs splayed, her dress a gray farm woman's dress with a stained apron. She sounded like the poodle. "Damn it, Tom, you're going to do something about them birds?" The tenant and his wife sat in the lawn chairs watching, thinking they should do something. Tell the old woman, maybe, that the birds wouldn't bother the seedlings. But they thought she would fight with them, scream at them because she was angry and old. They thought it best to say something later when she calmed herself. The next day the landlord said he liked the birds and said the garden had grown enough to be out of danger. He said he had always liked quail. Even when he was a boy he had thought them beautiful and fine eating, but there was his wife. The landlord said his wife would most likely be better in a day or two, and the garden was always a sore spot with her, because they canned for winter. When the poppies bloomed and the sweet peas came in, 3 broods were hatched. The first chicks appeared at breakfast with the hen leading a weaving path to the corn and the cock running half circles behind them, keeping the chicks in line. They counted 10 new birds in the 3 families, and they rose even earlier so they could linger over breakfast and smell the drying mustard weed behind the garden. One hen left her chicks for evening strolls down the front sidewalk. She would promenade her family punctually at 5:30. The landlord and his wife sat on the front porch one night, not believing the hen would show as the tenant had described. They all laughed when the hen strutted by on cue. The landlord and his wife drank beer and told them about the depression when there was drought and they had to save everything. The old woman said she still had those habits and also said she'd been overly concerned about the garden. The tenant couple thought the landlord's wife would be just fine. When it was autumn, they canned apples and applesauce. The landlord took in his squash, carrots, tomatoes, beets. The landlord's wife traded canned cherries for their canned apples. The landlord cut back the garden, and the tenant helped the old man put up storms, turn the garden, and clean the garage. He bought a 50-pound bag of cracked corn and built a feeding trough of redwood. With the trough on the window sill, there was enough room for all 18 quail, even with the window closed. The covey was in good shape for the winter. He told her the birds would have an easy winter with the cracked corn and said they would stay near food. The chicks had grown. They were well fed, sleek with new adult plumage. The original 8 were rotund, fattened by the summer's corn. He assured her the birds would be fine for the winter. When the leaves turned and there was frost again, they closed the kitchen window. She could not feed the hen crumbs, but they could talk now without frightening the birds. They talked about the summer with the quail, waking them early. He told her he had hoped all his life that it would someday be like it had been that summer. When there was a hard frost and cold morning, they lingered in bed, awake, warm next to each other, thinking of the quail, thinking of the warmth. The morning after the first snowfall, the quail were gone. He brushed the snow out of the feeding trough and replaced the wet corn. The covey did not come back that night, and the corn had not been touched the next morning. He told her the quail had probably gone to the hills outside town for winter. He told her there was better cover in the hills and that the hunting season was over, so they would be fine. He told her the birds would be back in the spring and it would be the same again. The tenant and his wife slept late and hard through the winter. The winter was dry, bleak, and cold. There was talk of drought for summer. The landlord hoarded water for his garden by storing it in old oil drums. The tenant changed the corn often, spreading some on the frozen ground. But the quail did not return, and the sparrows and jays ate the corn. His wife said she knew the quail would be back in the spring, and it would be the same. When the ground thawed and there was the mud and dirt smell outside, the tenant saw the landlord cleaning his garage and went to help. When he saw the plastic bag full of gray and brown feathers, down feathers, plume feathers, some with bits of dried skin, when he saw that sack and the large chicken wire trap that had not been in the garage before, he asked the landlord how he had managed to catch all the birds at once. The landlord said it had been his wife's idea. They had waited for the first winter storm and trapped the birds when they were huddled together. He said they had been fine eating. The tenant did not tell his wife about the bag or trap, but it was as if she knew. After a while, he quit putting out the corn, and when the 50-pound bag began to rot, he threw it in the trash. And that story was The Quail by Rolf Yngve from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Sheppard and James Thomas. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Story program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.